last time.
Your fashion words that fools lamp up and call yourself a poet. Tattooed pretense upon your skin so everyone will know it. And I guessed your favorites one by one, and oh, to your surprise, from Damnic Cave to Kerouac, they stood less out.
Hello, I'm Matt Everett, and you're listening to The First Time here on Six Music. This is the show where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and take a look at the pivotal first musical moments that made them who they are today. And this week we're joined by a singer and songwriter from the northeast of England whose incredible voice, fearless lyrics and sense of humour have permeated four critically acclaimed albums and made her a mainstay here at Six Music for many a year. I'm very pleased to welcome my guest on The First Time this week, Nadine Shah. And you just heard Fool from Nadine's 2015 album Fast Food, and over the next hour we'll discuss the whole of her musical life so far, her eclectic musical childhood influences, her passion for jazz, and how gigging in a pizza restaurant helped her strike up a friendship with Amy Winehouse. We'll also detail her obsession with artists including Scott Walker and Nick Cave, and what it feels like to be labelled a political artist. But I started by asking, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time she was aware of music?
My mum was pretty musical. I mean, she couldn't hold a note to save her life, bless her. Her karaoke song was leader of the pack because of all the talky bits. But there was music in the house all the time, and she loved girl bands, especially. So the Shangri-Las, the Crystals, and I'd listen to all them. You should have them just because my mum was a stay-at-home mummy, and she just had music blasting in the house. I mean, she did it the right way, you know. She had music blasting in the house all the time. So, yeah. Things like Buddy Holly, the Shangri-Las and stuff like that. But that was my first introduction to music properly, I guess.
But it was just around everywhere. It wasn't like, oh, we're putting a tape on. It's like it was just constant.
She always, always had music playing, just in every different room she'd go into. Obviously, it wasn't like you couldn't hook up speakers, so they all synchronised in those days. But there'd be a different sound system. There's one in the kitchen, you know, I guess a tape player. Yeah, different tape players and cassette players in different rooms. And they just kind of followed her around. It's lovely.
They told me he was bad.
And then otherwise, my dad, he didn't listen to music in the house. He'll tell you it's because he was too busy working. But he played music in the car. And my dad, being Pakistani, would play this beautiful, beautiful Pakistani music, Sufi music, ghazals. And I hated it. I couldn't stand it. I mean, I couldn't, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't Mariah Carey or things that I liked. At least my mum's music was, I could understand what they were saying. But I'm really appreciative of that time with him in the car, because it, I think it taught me how to hear, how to listen, really, to other types of music. And I think in some way it's probably informed something in what I do, in that I have a love for all different kinds of music from all over the world. Even if I don't understand what somebody's saying, it resonates quite deeply still.
So when you were like getting a little bit older, did you start to, because when you're young, it's just all music. Was there something you were like starting to think, oh, I like that song coming on, or I like her voice? When was the moment you started to pick out things and start to choose the music then?
Yeah, well, I was a pretty poorly kid. I was in hospital for a long time when I was little. I had this thing called Henox purpura, I think I'm saying it correctly, but I was in hospital for a long time and I'd like lost the use of my legs and things like that. And so when I came out of hospital, I think I was only about 9 years old. And because I was a poorly kid, I had to stay indoors a lot, you know, when it was cold, and I couldn't do a lot of the things with other kids. And I was kind of almost kind of wrapped in bubble wrap. And in that time, I sat and listened to loads of music. And at that point, it was just Mariah Carey, really, exclusively Mariah Carey.
Daydream, is that right?
Daydream, Fantasy. I mean, Hero was my first kind of song I ever sang in public.
tell me about that. Tell me about that moment then.
Singing competitions in school. I mean, no, that's a lie. The first time I sang in public was like a school assembly, and it was horrifying. I've still got kind of trauma remembering that. I had to sing this song in front of the whole school called The Friendly Cow. It was, oh, and then, you know, weeks after, kids would walk past and moo at me. Oh, it was there.
Oh, God, I laughed then, but I just felt really awful for a moment. It was like,
I know, poor me.
Yeah, but that didn't put you off.
Well, it put me off cows for a while. But yeah, Mariah Carey, Hero, I would just sit and imitate her. And yeah, in a school competition, sang Mariah Carey, Hero, won a little trophy, which I then used as an ashtray when I grew up. And I think that gives you the confidence when you get accolades, you know, even now or at a young age, it is nice. It's, you can say that they don't matter, but they do feel very nice when they come along. And then a hero comes along with the strength to carry on, and you cast your fears aside, and you know you can survive. So when you feel like hope is gone, look inside you and be strong, and you finally see the truth that a hero lies in you. Oh, oh. It was the thing, I was better at that than anybody else in my school. Definitely. And I, you know, I couldn't do cartwheels. I wasn't great at maths or many other things. So it's exciting when you find a thing that's yours, and kind of sets you apart a bit. So yeah, the singer.
What was the first gig you went to?
It was Blur.
And really? Are you being honest, or are you just saying something cool because it was really like Shawaddy Waddy doing a pantomime?
Okay, I actually did tell a little bit. Blur was my second concert.
Right.
My first one was Peter Andre.
Nothing wrong with Peter Andre.
And I remember we were sat really far back, and then we, like, I don't know how, but we got right into the third row. I could almost taste the sweat dripping off his torso. Oh. Disgusting. Is that a gig? Yeah, it's a gig, isn't it? It's a gig. Peter Andre, then, yes. Peter Andre.
But the first gig was Blur. Where was that? What do you remember from that one? When was that?
What was it called back then? The Telly West Arena. And so I must have been about 10 or 11, but I knew I was very young because I had to be chaperoned by my big brother. He'd actually taken me to Peter Andre before that. So he was quite, he wasn't too, angry about taking me to the Blur gig because it was a bit cooler than, well, a bit cooler than Peter Andre. But amazing. Just fell in love with them. I think it was Park Life. I think it was that album. But their energy on stage, I just thought, I think also there's a lot of bands where I like a lot of serious music these days, but I can see, I think there's like the tongue-in-cheek nature of the lyrics that Damon was writing then was really appealing to young people as well. And I still go back and listen to that album all the time.
I get up when I want, except on Wednesdays when I get rudely awakened by the dustman. I put my trousers on, have a cup of tea, and I think about leaving the house. I feed the pigeons, I sometimes feed the sparrows too. It gives me a sense of enormous well-being. And then I'm happy for the rest of the day, safe in the knowledge there will always be a bit of my heart devoted to it.
I love Blur, and that's the reason that I work with my now producer and co-writer, Ben Hillier, because he made a Blur album. He made Think Tank. So thanks to Blur, found Ben.
Yeah, the sort of popular idea is that at that point, you know, Blur were almost a little bit like, oh, we've got like these kids down the front of the gigs. But actually, I think it's brilliant that you can be making really interesting, like quite challenging and quite strange pop music, which Blur do as well as they, and have an audience that goes from 10 to like 45. I think it's quite an achievement, that era. Because it was quite special, wasn't it, I think, for a lot of people.
Well, yeah, I was never able to go and see them in some club in Essex, or those great ones that they played years ago. I was never able to go to those. But this was like a safe space that, you know, children could go to as well. I've been a huge fan of theirs for years and years and years and years. And I'm really grateful for that because, yeah, I did find Ben Hillier via them.
What's the Blur song we should play at this moment then?
Well, because I found Ben off the back of Think Tank. So Ben produced all the best songs on Think Tank. And Out of Time.
Where's the love song? Set us free. Everything turning the wrong way round. And I don't know what love will be. But if we start dreaming now, Lord knows we'll never clear the clouds. And you've been so busy lately that you haven't found the time to open up your mind and watch the world spinning gently out of time.
What was the first Nick Cave album or song that you fell for? Or is it just the whole world, isn't it, really, the Nick Cave
No, world? I mean, when we put out the first album, I think it was my first EP. And the first EP was called Aching Bones.
Yep.
And Aching Bones itself is quite a visceral, macabre sounding track. And people had said, oh, you know, she's a bit like Nick Cave. And I said, who? I had no idea who Nick Cave was, or PJ Harvey, actually. But Nick Cave kept being mentioned a lot. And so I thought, well, I best listen to see, you know, if they're comparing me to him, I hope he's good. Wasn't that taken aback by what I first heard? I thought he was all right. I thought it was weird. I didn't really get it. But I forced myself because I thought if all these cool people like him, I listened and listened and listened and listened. And then I fell in love with him and I still am. I'm in awe of what he does, man. He's incredible. And I've seen him live so, so many times now. I performed, I supported him. This was a really cool show, actually. It was in Berlin. And it was an incredible venue. Actually, it was quite a haunting, terrifying venue. It was this amphitheatre in Berlin, which was designed by Goebbels. And you had to access the stage and via this bunker. And Hitler had held a Wagner concert there once. So, I mean, it's steeped in some really dark history, but now it's filled with loads of beautiful stuff, you know, like this Nick Cave concert. And I meet him after the show and I'm terrified, and he's very, very polite. It's like an after show party, and just kind of, oh, you know, I think he said something to me like, you know, we don't normally have support artists, so, you know, I hope you enjoyed it. And I'm like, but anyway, I was a bit disappointed we didn't get to talk that much. But then I'm backstage collecting all my items to go home, and I'm walking down the corridor and I just see him there eating a pizza, and I burst out laughing, and he's like, what's so funny? And I was like, sorry, just, you know, Nick Cave eating a pizza. And so he starts laughing as well, because it's funny. And then he just goes, even vampires need to eat. And I'm like, yeah. Well, they do. And he just, and then we sat, we stood and we chatted in the corridor for ages. And he's funny and he's daft. You know, you see certain artists and you're just kind of terrified that they're going to be ever so serious and take themselves so, so seriously. He was a really kind, funny man. I really liked him. I can't think of much of these released that I'm not in love with now. But he's probably one of those artists that it doesn't matter what he puts out, I'm going to love it, but it helps that it's great.
I don't believe in an interventionist God. But I know, darling, that you do. If I did, I would kneel down and ask him. Not to intervene when it came to you. Well, not to touch a hair in your head, leave you as you are. If he felt he had to direct you, then direct you into my arms. Into my arms, oh Lord, into my arms, oh Lord, into my arms, oh Lord, into my arms.
Jazz as a genre it's very important to you. It's something that's kind of that propelled you early on. Where did that come from?
I guess from a young age, when my mother realised that it wasn't Shirley Bassey singing upstairs, like, because she would hear, I'd be in the room and she'd just hear me singing and assumed I was listening to records. And then she realised that I had this really big, big, very good vocal. And so she encouraged me to start singing other songs. You know what it was? It was actually via, because I started singing gospel music, but that was via Eva Cassidy.
Okay.
So I guess at the time my mother would have heard Eva Cassidy was on heavy rotation on Teddy Wogan's show, on his radio show. Bless him, what a lovely fella. And yeah, so I started singing these Eva Cassidy songs, and many of those were gospel. So my mum found this. Now she got the Yellow Pages out, like in the Yellow Pages, and searching for recording studios. And I ended up going to one in it's an old pit village called Concert in Newcastle. Went there and recorded with two old fellas, Mick and Denny. And she'd come in with me, and we had these really gross, horrible sounding backing tracks that she'd ordered, you know, via post somewhere.
Yellow Pages, brilliant.
Oh, and they're terrible. But I'd go and record these gospel songs at the studio with Mick and Denny. And I got on really well with them, but they were all jazz heads. And so they said, well, how about singing this? This is Nina Simone. I said, who's he? I like him. And it was that was a real revelation here in Nina for the first time when they played me Nina, because I didn't realise you could be a woman and sing it with that low range. And they encouraged that low range in my vocal. And that's kind of where all that started from. I just fell in love with Nina and everything that she did. And then the Cole Porter songbook. And then finally, my mum and dad agreed to let me move to London and quit school when I was 16, 17, possibly. Moved to London, lived with my brother, who hated it because obviously he was like some cool art student. I moved in with him and I started singing at Pizza Express restaurants. You'd get dough balls and you'd get 50 quid. It was all right.
That still sounds pretty good to me. It still sounds like quite a good deal.
I mean, during COVID, I would have taken that any day. You know, you get 2 glasses of wine, dough balls, and 50 quid.
Before we move on, what's the Nina track? If you had to play one, if you had to choose one, what should we play here?
Oh, there's so many Nina tracks that I'm in love with, but I guess Mississippi Goddamn. She's a pioneer. I mean, not only did she... I mean, she essentially invented a genre as well, didn't she, when she blended classical music and jazz together. But there was... I had two other good friends growing up, and one of them, her favourite was Ella Fitzgerald. Other one's favourite was Billie Holiday. And mine was Nina Simone. We'd often have, like, playful arguments about who was better. And I was like, listen, lasses, just don't bother. Nina wrote Mississippi Goddamn. She wrote her own songs, and heavily, heavily political songs that were, you know, super important and still are to this day. So, Mississippi Goddamn.
Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi Goddamn. Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi Goddamn. Can't you see it? Can't you feel it? It's all in the air. I can't stand the pressure much longer. Somebody say a prayer. Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows. Show tune, but the show hasn't been written for it yet. Hound dogs on my trail, school children sitting in jail, black cat cross my path. I think every day's gonna be my last. Land of mine, we all gonna get it in due time. I don't belong here, I don't belong there. I've even stopped believing in prayer. Don't tell me, I'll tell you. Me and my people just about do. I've been there, so I know. Keep on saying, go slow. Washing the windows, picking the cotton, you're just plain rotten, you're too damn lazy, you're thinking it's crazy. Where am I going? What am I doing? I don't know, I don't know. Just try to do your very best. Stand up, be counted with all the rest. Bet you thought I was kidding, didn't you? Picket lines, school boycotts, they try to say it's a communist plot. All I want is equality for my sister, my brother, my people and me.
Tell me about being in London at that age. What were your first impressions of kind of young girl in the big city?
It was great. I lived in Camden. None of my other friends had left home, so I was about a 5-minute walk away from the Barfly. And so all my buddies would come and stay with me and would all go to the Barfly and see what was going on there. It's where I first met Lamo. But it was just the most exciting time. Camden then, I mean, it's different now, but it was buzzing, proper buzzing. There was a place called Marathon Kebab, which was round the corner from my place as well. And there was this guy called Daniel, American fella, who played guitar, like the back room. I always wondered, like, why is there 10 fellas that work in this kebab shop? And then you soon realise why when you go through the back and it's just mayhem. And you get everybody from the Primrose Hill set to, you know, some drug addict over here, or, you know, any, or a student there, and anybody, everybody and anybody's in that place. And this guy, Daniel, played guitar. His guitar was called Nadine. because apparently Chuck Berry gave him the guitar and it was Sweet Nadine. I didn't believe it for a second, but I did enjoy dancing on the tables when he played my song Sweet Nadine. But honestly, it was just, it was an incredible, incredible time. And I, you know, luckily I kept diaries because some of this stuff is just mad. And I think like, oh my gosh, what was I doing at 17? I'd be terrified to do like some of those things now. But it was just properly vibrant and like something out of a film. It was what I hoped London would be.
Was that about the time that you met Amy? Because this is always something that's going to kind of, that people are going to find endlessly fascinating.
I mean, I think I hammed it up a little bit too much. I met her via the, because I would work at the Pizza Express Jazz Club on Dean Street. My manager at the time owned that club. And it doesn't sound so glam, does it, the Pizza Express Jazz Club? But I, honestly, for anybody listening,
it's a proper thing. Yeah, it was a real place. It was a real location, that place. It really was, yeah.
Yeah, it was amazing on Dean Street, near Dean Street. And it was, but my manager at the time would just have me sit at the bar. Anytime an act was on, he was like, you never have to buy a ticket. You come in, you sit at the bar, there's always a seat for you, and you watch everything. So I saw the likes of Georgie Fame, Mose Allison. Yeah, Mose Allison was the best.
Didn't you perform with Mose Allison?
Not in public, but once the club had shut, they'd always like let me hang around. And I went up to him and I was saying, you know, oh, but you didn't play Parchment Farm. And he'd said something along the lines of, I don't play Parchment Farm. And I said, well, I really like Parchment Farm. And he said, well, I'll play Parchment Farm for you. So he sits me down on the stool, on the piano stool with him, and he plays it. And I don't think at that moment in time I realised how mad or how incredible that experience was. But even when I tell the story now, I go, oh, that didn't happen. It happened. You know, and things like that would happen often, you know, in that place. And you know, one night I'm at the bar and I meet Amy, who could outdrink me, which was quite impressive. And she was just funny. She made me laugh so, so much. And it turned out we both lived quite close by to each other. And so I think when I first told the story, I was speaking to somebody else, like, oh, we're friends for a long time. I went through an old diary. It was about 2.5 weeks we were friends. But we were like, you know, we'd share a bed together and she would sing this song and I remember it really, really vividly. I'd always ask her to sing it to me when we'd go to bed. I think about 3-4 times this happened. There is no greater love. It was beautiful. I loved hearing her sing that. And I think it's on her first album on Frank. She has a cover of it on there and it's beautiful. Her version's stunning.
There is no greater love than what I feel. No sweeter song, no heart so true. There is no greater thrill than what you bring. No sweeter song than what you sing to me. Ooh, you're the sweetest thing. In all the world, it's true. No greater love than what I feel for you.
That was There Is No Greater Love by Amy Winehouse. The choice of my guest here on the first time this week, Nadine Shah. Join me after the break when I'll talk to Nadine about Mercury nominations and lockdown albums. But first, it's the Six Music News.
Six Music. BBC Radio, Six Music.
BBC News at 1:30. The Education Secretary has said he would support cutting the coronavirus self-isolation period from 7 to 5 days in England if the move were recommended by experts at the UK Health Security Agency. Nadeem Zahawi said scientists were examining if the shortening could lead to higher levels of infection, but the Welsh Health Minister, Eluned Morgan, doesn't think it's the right idea.
I would be reluctant to do that unless there's very clear clinical evidence to suggest that that would be safe to do it. We need to assess the reduction from 10 days to 7 days before we go any further than that. It would be counterproductive to allow people out who are still infectious, and so I think we'd have to be very careful.
Mr. Zahawi has also insisted there are no plans to end universal free lateral flow tests after a newspaper report suggested it was being considered. He said he was puzzled by the Sunday Times article and didn't recognise it at all. The chief executive of King's College Hospital in London has admitted that he worries about losing staff who refuse to get vaccinated against coronavirus. Dr. Clive Kay said about 10% of workers at the hospital were yet to be jabbed. NHS staff have until the beginning of next month to get their first dose and have to be fully vaccinated by April or they could lose their jobs. Dr. Kay hopes many will change their mind.
We're already seeing a number of staff choosing to be vaccinated. We're having conversations with staff, their line managers are having conversations. We have a helpline where colleagues can contact and seek clarification help. So I don't want at this stage to predict or give any numbers. I think ultimately if individuals choose not to, this is their choice, their personal choice.
Labour's Shadow Chancellor Rachel Reeves has said the UK is uniquely exposed to rising international energy prices because the government got rid of the gas reserves and failed to invest in nuclear plants and renewables. The party has called for a windfall tax on North Sea gas and oil producers to fund measures aimed at reducing energy bills. The government says the existing energy price cap is protecting millions of consumers. This pensioner in Kent, Tony Hughes, says ministers must do more.
If the cap is reviewed and the 50% that is being spoken about is implemented, our energy bills will increase by £1,400 a year. When the next election, people will not forget this because people are going to be hurt. You know, they're going to have a lower standard of living.
The RNLI says a Coast Guard helicopter had to be used yesterday to rescue three people after they were cut off by the rising tide in East Sussex. The charity said its lifeboat crew couldn't safely carry out the rescue because of 4-metre-high waves. A spokesman said people who are planning coastal walks or seaside activity must check the weather and the tides before setting out. And that's the Six Music News. The next update's at 2:30.
BBC Radio. Six Music.
Where was
Hello, welcome back to The First Time with me, Matt Everett, the show where we ask an influential musician about the pivotal musical moments that made them who they are. And this week I'm talking to Nadine Shah. You just heard Out the Way from Nadine's 2017 album Holiday Destination, a record that garnered huge praise, a Mercury Prize nomination, and a new audience hooked in by Nadine's often confrontational but always compassionate songs. We'll get to that era shortly, but let's go back as I asked Nadine about the very first song she wrote.
Oh, no, because I don't want people to search for it online.
Okay.
It actually is the first song I ever wrote, and it's my first ever single as well. It's called Dreary Town.
I know that was the first single. I didn't realise that was the first thing that you wrote.
First thing I ever wrote. Off the back of a very good friend, a poor man, you know, he had a harrowing, horrible mental health illness. It was bipolar. It turns out now, we now know what he had was bipolar. And he passed away. He took his own life, sadly, very, very young. And I think that was the first time where I thought, I always had this digital, I've still got it, this digital, like a little Casio keyboard and a piano. And I'd play things on it, but I could never really get to grasps of putting lyrics with the little things, the melodies I was playing. And then he passed away, and I guess it was just really, and it flowed out of me. I don't know, it really was. It was cathartic to write about my friend who had passed away. And then I played it to somebody. I played it to my brother. And because I recorded it on GarageBand or something, and he didn't believe I'd played it. So then I recorded myself on my computer playing it and singing it at the same time, and I put it on YouTube to prove to him that I was doing it. And that video is now on YouTube. I was quite embarrassed for people to see it. But then in hindsight now, I don't know how old I was, but I think it's quite a sweet thing to have on the internet and for people to see somebody's progression. I mean, I'm not saying I'm like Lady Gaga, but I love watching videos of her back in the day in New York where it's just her and the piano. I love watching that simply. I love seeing how the progression, how it all worked. I think that's really helpful for other artists to see how that can happen.
We were down and out in London, sharing beds and sharing money.
Probably talk about Scott Walker. Is that a good
always
person to choose? What when did you first fall in love with Scott?
Like from at 5, my mother loved Scott Walker. Well, she loved Scott Walker. Hey, Scott Walker loved my mother as well. It turns out she was in some place in the Lake District because he's a real Anglophile, right? And she was in some place backpacking in the lakes at a bar there, and this fella's next to her. It's Scott Walker, okay. And he has to buy her a drink. She realises that it's him. She's too shy. No, I'm too shy. Honestly, that shyness, Heather. I should only just said yes. So, you know, he kind of followed her around for a little while, but she never gave in. But she was such a huge admirer of Scott Walker and the Walker brothers, really. So I heard loads of the Walker brothers growing up. And I remember, it was years and years later, a friend of mine took me to see that film, the documentary about him, which is 20th Century Man, and said, listen, I think you're going to like this. It's dark and this guy's weird. I said, oh, well, I'm in. And I'd kind of forgotten about Scott Walker at this point, and I'm maybe 21. And I walk out the film screening and my friend says, so what did you think? And I went, well, he's my favourite artist of all time. And he said, well, you know, you didn't You didn't really know who he was when you walked in. I went, listen, he's my favourite artist of all time. It was love at first sight. And then became, you know, obsessed when you want to find out every single thing they've ever done. So, you know, Scott, 1, 2, 3, the whole thing. And then I discover albums like Tilt. And I play it to my mother and she's horrified. And she's saying, no, what happened to, is he okay? Is he all right? I'm like, yeah, he's fine. He's blazing a trail, Mum. He's blazing a trail. This is what I'm going to do one day. Everything about him, I got to meet him once. Very briefly after that, there was a show at the Royal Albert Hall. And people were covering his songs and I was devastated I wasn't asked to do one. There's an after-show party that I sneak into around the corner and he's there talking to Jarvis Cocker, Ovs, and in his baseball cap. I mean, the amount of old fellas in baseball caps I've followed around West London thinking it could be him, and it's not. Can't count. Anyway, this is him, and he's about to leave, and I strategically put myself at the bottom of the stairs so he has to pass me when he leaves. And I have nothing to say. I just, Scott, I think I called him sir, and I'm kind of stuttering a bit, but really taken aback. And he kind of puts his hands on my shoulders and goes, it's okay. It's a pleasure to meet you too. Have you had a nice evening? And I'm like, yeah, really nice evening, sir. Thanks so much. You know, and he, you know, and he leaves, but he was so, he's just a very kind, calm, great man. Yeah, I think, you know, favourite artist of all time, Scott.
It's raining today. And I'm just about to forget the train window girl that wonderful day we met. She smiles through the smoke from my cigarette. It's raining today, but once there was summer and you and dark little and sleeping late afternoons. Those moments descend on my windowpane.
First album, what do you remember from recording the first album? Because there is that weight of expectation and often it's quite hard to be yourself when you're doing your first album because you haven't quite found your way often as an artist, I don't think, with the first record. Yeah. It's kind of it's difficult to get it right if you try too hard almost. I think it's the best debut albums are the ones that's just, this is just me, boom, straight out the gate. I'm just going to get it on tape. I'm not going to think about it too much. What do you remember from doing yours?
It took ages. It took so long. I had like a bunch of demos and my manager at the time, I went and met a whole different bunch of producers. And each producer wanted to, pretty much all of them, they wanted to like put my vocal really far forward, loads of reverb and loads of strings. There's a bit of me that regrets that I didn't go down that route. Now, you know, I could be in a massive house. And but I really didn't want to do that. And then I come across Ben Hillier, this brilliant weirdo who listens to what I want to do. On our first meeting, what do you want to do? And I think in that first meeting, it was over a cup of tea somewhere in East London. I went to meet him. And in that conversation, I think I had decided in that moment, listen, if you produce me, then it's going to be 50-50. You're putting in as much as I'm putting in. And I want us to actually write together. That's actually, it's got my name on it, but the writing is all me and Ben Hillier together. It's a partnership. And if I ever worked with somebody else, I feel like I wouldn't even be able to call it Nadine Shaw. I'd have, you know, use a different name. And I have many different names I want to use at some point. Karachi Kidnap being one of them. But it was a really beautiful experience working with Ben. But it took us a long time because there were some of the songs were heavily piano based. And then the other side were the kind of fuller band songs. And so we tried to make all the songs fit together And eventually we just went, listen, no. A record, a vinyl, has two sides. And so on one side, we're going to have the piano songs. And on the other side, the louder band ones. It felt like a really weird thing to do at the time. So it didn't feel like a coherent body of work. And I'm sure if you have the album on shuffle, it doesn't really make sense how you get from Dreary Town to The Devil. But actually listening to the album in a whole, it does seem to work. And it took us a long time to get signed as well, because people thought it was weird. But eventually we found somebody who took a punt on it and just said, yeah, I like what you're doing. And I really enjoyed making that album. The piano stuff we actually made, because we didn't have any budget at the time. We weren't on a label. So we used, for half the album, all the piano stuff. That's all recorded in my dad's curtain warehouse up north. And it was, again, freezing. And you can hear the kind of the metal shutters shaking in the background, which all adds to the very gothic ambience.
But That's cool, though.
It was such an enjoyable experience. I think, genuinely, my favourite album to make of all them that we've made to date. It was weird, and I loved it. It was, you know, it was my dream, wasn't it? So I think Ben really enjoyed making that album, too. I still get really giddy anytime we hear one of our songs on the radio, but it's that thing where it depends on how you define success, right? So I teach a lot of young kids now as well, and there's always that thing when I ask them, you know, how do you define success? And for a lot of them, it's like, you know, selling millions and millions of albums and doing this and that, which is fair enough, totally fair enough. But for me, my expectations weren't that far out of reach, which I think is actually a really healthy thing to do. And I'm glad that that's what mine was. Mine was, all I wanted was to have a body of work of my own songs, enough to record my own album and have it on vinyl and it to be on a record label and be released. That's all I wanted, honestly. And so everything since that is just a lovely little bonus. And so it kind of means, you know, I don't think it means that I was not reaching high enough, but it's protective in a way that, you know, if everything stopped tomorrow, hey, I've got enough stories and I've had a blast. I've had a really lovely time. And I honestly think I could have said that to you at the end of every album. Like, if this is it today, I've had a really nice time. Listen to me. These streets, they are yours and they're mine. You're not staying.
Because for lots of people, they first heard about you after Holiday Destination, because it got kind of nominated, and also there was a lot of stories that you told in that record that people really connected to. Yeah, you know, all of a sudden you're on red carpets, being nominated for awards. It kind of changes everything. But then again, you're also using that forum to, as I say, tell really important stories.
Yeah, I mean, there was always a bit of me that And there still is, you know, there's always a bit of me that worried about looking opportunistic, righteous. And I get called that a lot, and I really don't mind. I don't mind being criticised. It's bound to happen. People are going to like or dislike you for, you know, valid reasons or invalid reasons, whatever, and it's fine. But, you know, my brother was and is an incredible documentary maker. He's a filmmaker, and he was, at the time, he was working in Syria. And this is before, you know, it was front page news about the civil war that was happening there and the refugee crisis. It was before that time. And so when he was telling me, he would always come back and tell me the stories of what he's seen. And it was, you know, harrowing stories. And I was getting angry, like, why do I not know that? Shouldn't I? I mean, I watch the news. Why don't I hear about these things? He's like, well, you know, it's just not there yet. And so I wanted to put that into my music, use that as a form of, as a way to speak to people as well, as a way to spread information. And then, you know, 2016 was a terrible year. I mean, well, we thought that was a bad year, and then we had 2020 come along. But I wanted to write about it because sometimes it happens where I think I never really thought that I wanted to be a political artist.
Yeah,
I didn't really think I was smart enough, I guess, as well, or brave enough. I don't know if you have to be. Maybe you have to be pretty stupid to speak about what you think these days, I think. But I never really thought of myself as a political artist. But it got to a point then when it was impossible to write about anything else because I was so angry, so angry, like so many others as well. Yeah, so we made that album, and the response was, you know, it was beautiful.
Spoke just before Kitchen Sink was released, and it just about the time Ladies with Babies had sort of come out, and there was a real, you could sense how incredibly proud you were of that record, how much it all came together for that album.
I'm gutted that it was birthed in 2020. I was devastated because it's my proudest work to date. I remember making it and feeling super confident and just like confident in a studio, confident lyrically, personally as well. Like I kind of know what kind of an artist I am. I'm this woman and I do that. It was much more revealing of kind of me as a person, which I was a bit nervous about really, because I'd just kind of been macabre up until then. And, there's parts of it where there's a lot of my sense of humour in it. It feels like a proper reflection of who I am as a person and the work that I really wanted to make. And it was devastating that it, you know, in 2020, that's when it had to come out. And so we didn't get to play it live for a year and a bit. We eventually did. We did this one show at the Barbican, because I thought, you know, if we hadn't played it anywhere, I wasn't going to go to any old venue and premiere the whole album in full. And that was a luxury in itself, getting to play an album in full. You don't normally get those opportunities, but it was incredible to do that, to play the whole album at the Barbican. Yeah, I mean, I feel a bit, I guess a lot of people got to live with it and give it more time of listening because everyone was stuck indoors. And so that means that people really listened to the album properly as well. And so when we did eventually play it, I mean, we played this great show at, this was actually, I think, one of the biggest moments in my career that I'm never going to forget, was playing Green Man Festival this year in 2021. And we played the main stage, and it was that slot where it just goes into a kind of dusk. And it was rammed. Like, you couldn't see a bit of green on the floor. It was rammed. And so I just assumed everybody's there waiting for the next act. Yeah, honestly. But they're singing along to loads of the lyrics. And after we finish, the applause, the appreciation from the audience was massive. And I'm, you know, I cry at anything. I was in tears. It was just overwhelming. And then, you know, once we leave the stage, I notice there's an exodus of people just leaving. So they come to see me, you know, and it was incredible. And that felt like, okay, yeah, we're here now. And this is what we do.
it to make your maneuver. 1 year younger, call me a cougar. All dressed up, think I did it for you. Make eye contact, think I adore you. It's a pity, it's your maneuver. Your conversation makes me a bore you. Judging by the pace I was walking, no time to stop, no time for talking.
And the final thing, what's the last song we're going to play? What should we go out on? It can be anything. It can be something of yours. It can be something of someone else's. It can be something you've loved your whole life or something you heard on the radio this morning.
Yeah, I was just the other day, I was listening to a song of the Lars and thinking, oh, where is he? What's he up to? And I've started revisiting that album. And that Lars album is one of my favourites of all time. There's no stinkers on it. It's incredible. So there she goes.
There she goes.
And she's off.
Of course, the last with There She Goes, the final choice of my guest on the first time this week, Nadine Shah. And that is the end of this week's programme. You can, however, listen to last week's first time with Kelly Okereke from Block Party and a load of other classic first times all up on BBC Sounds. I'll be here next week talking to performer, poet, playwright and author Kay Tempest. But for now, I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.